This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETsurvey.com. That's DoucetSurvey.com.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With a market value up to $2.50 an ounce, it is called on the internet liquid gold. In a good year, a single producer can make up to $20,000 selling it. Mothers around the country are cashing in by selling breast milk to other families, to biotech companies, neonatal care units, and even bodybuilders. Once primarily donation-based, the commercial sale of breast milk is giving rise to an industrial commodity and questions about how trustworthy and equitable this mommy market is. Andrew Pollack writes about biotechnology and business and science for The New York Times and joins us to break down the business of breast milk. Andrew, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
So there's a lot of evidence that breast milk is healthiest for most babies. What are some of the benefits?
Well, it is, you know, it has evolved to be the optimal nutrition for babies. It also provides some protection against infections. The American Academy of Pediatrics has, you know, recommended babies be breastfed exclusively for 6 months and then continued on breast milk for at least another 6 months. I should point out there are some skeptics who think that the benefits of breast milk have been oversold, but generally that is the consensus.
There have for some time been organizations and informal networks for donating breast milk between families. How about for selling?
I think there has been some, but there's been new activity in two spheres. One, there are websites where women offer to sell their milk. One is called Only the Breast. I believe people can also use Craigslist or eBay or other websites. That is an unregulated market, typically unpasteurized. There are some concerns about the safety, but the dollars you can get might be greater. Then there are companies that collect breast milk and process it into products that they sell to neonatal intensive care units to be fed to extremely premature babies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write about this fast-growing business of these biotech companies buying breast milk. How much are they buying? How much do they pay?
Well, there are two companies. One that's been established for several years called Prolacta Bioscience. They only started paying last year. They pay $1 an ounce. So does their competitor, Medilac. Prolacta is doing about, I think this year they want to process about 3.4 million ounces. The nonprofit milk banks, collectively, there are 18 of them that in the U.S. and Canada that belong to this Human Milk Banking Association of North America. Collectively, they did about 3.5 million ounces last year.
When you say processing, I'm just wondering what they do. This is not breast milk in its purest form.
No, it's not. The extremely premature babies, and these are babies that are like 2 pounds, they can fit in the palm of a hand when they're born, they need more nutrition than what is available from breast milk. Normally, these babies would be, you know, in the womb getting nutrition, you know, from the mom's blood, essentially. So what Prolacta does is they concentrate the milk they get and they make a fortifier. It's a very high concentration of the proteins from breast milk, plus they add minerals. There's also a high level of some of the fats from breast milk. And this is added to breast milk as sort of a supplement for these babies.
Mm-hmm.
So for that, they they sell for $180 an ounce. And over the course of a treatment of these very tiny premature babies, they could be getting this supplement, this fortifier, for several weeks, and the total cost could be up to $10,000 per baby. It's almost like a medical product, almost like a drug in a sense. The other company, Medilac, makes just regular donor breast milk, but they sterilize it rather than pasteurize it. That means it does not have to be frozen or even refrigerated. It just comes in a pack and it can sit there on the shelf until you want to use it. The Medilac is sold for about $5 an ounce. You know, they pay the mothers $1 an ounce and they sell the sterilized milk for $5 an ounce.
So with the profit motive on that scale, there are some concerns about breast milk farming, quote unquote. What are they?
There are several concerns that, you know, this is in paying women for their breast milk. There are concerns that they might deprive their own baby of breast milk in order to sell more. There's concerns they might dilute their milk with water or with cow milk. There's concerns that they might take a drug or supplement or something that might be unhealthy in order to increase their output.
Mm-hmm.
I should note that Prolacta does have various testing to try to prevent this. You know, they do test for adulteration and dilution. They require notes from both the woman's doctor that she's healthy and from her baby's pediatrician that the baby's healthy, to sort of guard against the thought that the baby might be deprived in order for the mother to send more milk to mm-hmm. Prolacta.
And I imagine if you could make money selling your breast milk, you would be far less likely to donate it to a nonprofit or a free milk bank.
Yes, that is a concern, is that there could be a limited supply and that the payment will siphon the milk, you know, from the nonprofit milk banks to the for-profit companies. Some people counter that and say that really there could be plenty of milk for both. You know, the vast majority of women who are breastfeeding do not donate or sell, and many do not know about that they have those options, so that there could, if more people knew, be enough milk for both the for-profit and the nonprofit sector.
What do you think the prospect is for these for-profit companies trading in fortified milk or breast milk? Is there money behind them? Is there a future?
Well, it's still pretty early. The Prolacta has been around for many years, although they've really started, I think, sales around 2006. They are growing. I don't think they're profitable yet. As a biotechnology investment, it has not been a good one for their early investors. People who invest in biotech companies that are developing drugs, for instance, want to see the company go public in a few years, which Prolacta has not done, or want to see the company be acquired by a bigger company, some way to earn back the return on their investment. That has not happened yet for Prolacta. Medilac is a very new company. They've been having some cash flow problems, so some of the mothers have been complaining that they are not being paid for their milk in a timely fashion. There are, you know, delays in payments that are not being explained to them. And, you know, Prolacta's product has some good attributes, but it is very expensive, and it's been they are growing rapidly now, but they're still the vast majority of neonatal care units that handle these extremely premature babies do not use their product. And it's, you know, largely, I think, because of the cost.
Will breast milk be available for purchase in the grocery aisle at any time soon?
I kind of doubt that. Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, it's possible, but I haven't heard anything like that.
Andrew Pollack writes about the business of science and biotechnology for the New York Times. Andrew, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can find Andrew's article, Breast Milk Becomes a Commodity, with Mothers Caught Up in the Debate. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And what do you think? Should mother's milk be on the market, like sperm or eggs? Or should the exchange of milk be done only for donations, like organs? Does industrializing breast milk open up the path for exploitation of the most needy populations? You can let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. From wearables that track your sleep cycles to smart alarm clocks that wake you up at just the right time, there are lots of devices promising a perfect night's sleep. Up next, Word of Mouth gets a review of the booming sleep track.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whether it's exercise, productivity, or sex, many of today's connected consumers look at their lives through the lens of statistical data. The trend is called tracking, and it extends even to the hours when we are fast asleep. Shaughnessy Farrow is a Brooklyn-based writer who covers architecture and the sciences for Fast Company. Lately, she's been spending her nights trying out a growing number of sleep tracking apps and gadgets and so-called smart alarm clocks. Shaughnessy, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
First of all, this wasn't an assignment as much as a personal quest for you. Have I got that right?
Correct. Yeah, I sort of came to it by accident.
Well, what was the goal?
The goal was actually to be able to wake up without hitting snooze a lot and to wake up earlier and be a more productive morning person.
So the idea was that if you got enough sleep, you'd bound out of bed like a spring lamb.
Pretty much, which has never happened to me in my life.
Same here. I've always admired those people who can do that, but I might be on the same path as you. So you began with a gateway sleep tracker, an app that you can get on your smartphone. It's called Sleep Cycle. How does that work?
So basically, you download the app, and every night before you go to bed, you set your alarm for the morning and tell it a certain amount of information, like, you know, how did you exercise today? Did you have any alcohol? That sort of thing. And then you set it on your bed, and using the technology in your phone, it'll tell how much you're moving around in the middle of the night. So it can give you a rough estimate of whether you slept really deeply or whether you were sort of roaming around in the bed in the middle of the night.
What did you find with Sleep Cycle?
You know, I found that my sleep definitely varied throughout the week. You know, if I happened to have a wild party night on the weekends, I could tell that when I woke up in the morning, I hadn't slept that much, and I hadn't slept very deeply.
How does it show you? Does it do graphs or numbers or what?
Yeah, it comes up with a little graph, and so it's a kind of a line graph.
So next up, you tried a couple of gadgets, one a lot of listeners might recognize, the Fitbit, which most people I know use for exercise. How does it work with sleep tracking?
When you want to track your sleep, you tap on the Fitbit just a couple times rapidly, and it'll sort of vibrate, and that's how it knows that you are supposed to be going to sleep. And then you tap it again when you wake up, and that's when it puts the cutoff point. And then it gives you, using the same sort of accelerometer that tells you how much you're moving around during the daytime, it'll tell you how much you're moving around at night.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that with deep REM sleep, you are not moving?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So there's a fundamental question here. I mean, do you think knowing more about your sleep can lead to getting better sleep?
You know, I talked to a couple of researchers, and they pointed out that, you know, the first step to getting better sleep is just kind of paying attention. And one of the things that I noticed was that I was kind of cheating when I counted how much sleep I was getting. You know, I would sort of do the math wrong, and I would think that I got 8 hours of sleep when in reality it was more like six. And so paying attention to it really helped, but overall it didn't necessarily make my sleep much better. And, you know, one of the scientists I spoke to mentioned that as long as you don't remember that you woke up in the middle of the night, it kind of doesn't matter. You know, if you're an insomniac and you wake up in the middle of the night and lay there for an hour before you go back to sleep, that might matter, but just sort of the regular moving around, waking up for a few seconds and then falling back asleep doesn't really affect you in the morning.
Well, let's move on to the sleep tracker. These are alarm clocks. You tried two of them, the Aura and the S Plus. Now, what do they do?
Yeah, so they do sort of the same things that the you know, the Fitbit does. They track how much you move around in your sleep, but they do it a little bit more accurately with the Aura has a little sensor that you put under your bed, and then the S Plus uses radio waves to see how much you're moving. And so rather than just tell how much your wrist is moving around in the middle of the night, it can actually tell, you know, is your body moving. And they both have music that they'll play you a little bit of, you know, meditation type music as you fall asleep. The Aura has a special light that changes colors based on whether you're supposed to be going to sleep or whether you're supposed to be waking up, because blue light tends to wake people up. It has to do with the melatonin in your brain.
Mm-hmm. So those sound like sleep aids of some form or another.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not chemical aids, but they'll sort of put you on the right path.
How about the products themselves? Do they have to prove their efficacy in any way? I mean, do you know that the data that you're getting is accurate?
Not really. A lot of them actually do internal testing, but it's proprietary information. And so while Fitbit may say that they do a lot of tests and have a very accurate product, they don't share that with outside scientists for the most part. And so there's not an independent team that can actually verify that it's a good product.
So what's your takeaway? Is tracking sleeping worth it? Did you feel more rested when you woke up?
You know, I really like having a lot of data about myself. Wake me up with a very gentle light in the morning. But overall, I didn't feel like it totally changed my sleep patterns or really improved much. And so I don't know that I would actually spend the $300 that it costs to buy an Aura alarm clock. Mm. I've tried a couple things since then, things that I didn't get quite in time for the piece, like the Misfit, which is another Fitbit-like activity tracker. It knows automatically, theoretically, when you're asleep, so you don't have to tap it or anything. And so that passive kind of tracking I find really useful. I don't necessarily have to be paying attention to it.
Well, you could just try what a lot of people are taking this year, a Benadryl.
Yes.
Shaughnessy Farrow writes about architecture and science for Fast Company. Shaughnessy, thank you.
Thank you.
You can check out Shaughnessy's take on today's slate of sleep trackers. There's a link to look at that at wordofmouthradio.org. You don't need a sleep tracker to tell you if you have insomnia. If you lie awake for hours at night, chances are you're already desperate for a solution. Dale Connolly is host of the podcast Brain Talk from the Johns Hopkins Brain Science Institute. He recently spoke with a neurologist who says that for insomniacs, medication is not the only way to a good night's sleep.
Severe insomnia is the most common sleep complaint we see. I mean, you know, as you look to celebrities, with the biggest being Michael Jackson, Heath Ledger and whatnot, you know, these patients are very desperate. I mean, people are desperate to get some sleep and, you know, they're willing to, you know, go outside of the standard of care to find any form of treatment.
Dr. Rachel Salas is a neurologist at Johns Hopkins University who specializes in sleep medicine. She's trying to understand the causes of insomnia. Today on Brain Talk, finding ways to treat insomnia without medication. Dr. Salas and her team are evaluating the neurophysiology in the brain of someone with insomnia and their brain's plasticity, or the brain's ability to adapt and change. A recent study by Dr. Salas supports the fact that individuals with insomnia have greater plasticity and excitability in the brain.
There is a theory out there. It's called hyperarousal. And essentially, in basic terms, we believe that the light switch is always on. And it's not just nighttime. So insomnia disorder has now become a 24/7 disorder. These patients tend to have higher metabolism rates. Even their EEG, so their brainwave frequencies, are faster when they're supposed to be asleep.
Understanding more about this could lead to treatments for insomnia and likely other sleep disorders that don't involve medication. Treatments like transcranial magnetic stimulation.
It's like a handheld magnet, similar to a magnet that you would encounter, you know, if you were getting an MRI. There's a magnetic force that actually kind of converts into an electrical activity and actually can cause temporary changes in the brain.
Dr. Salas says there are many steps people with and without insomnia can take to improve their sleep without medication. First of all, they should improve what she calls bad sleep hygiene.
You go to bed at different bed times, wake up at different wakening times. You know, most people are watching TV, on the computer, texting, all sorts of bad things that we're doing within the hour before bedtime.
Our brains today no longer have natural cues for bedtime. Dr. Salas says we need to make sleep cycles consistent by going to bed and getting up at the same time every day. And she says there are small ways to improve sleep environments. Remove TVs, computers, and unfinished work from the room you sleep in. Use curtains that block light at night and let it in the morning. And Dr. Salas tells her patients to think about three positive things in their life before they go to sleep.
Human beings are naturally critical and negative, you know, especially at bedtime. You're always thinking about all the things you haven't done and how you don't have enough money, how you're getting older and all these other things. So you kind of ruminate on negative things. Well, those, you know, can feed insomnia. They can feed nightmares. So I encourage happy thoughts.
And Dr. Salas has an unusual technique for not feeding insomnia. She tells her patients to blow soap bubbles when they're in their pajamas right before going to bed.
It actually does three things. So it's having them do this heavy, relaxing breathing, which essentially is yoga breathing. But two, if they have insomnia, you know, those bubbles are blowing out. I try to get them to apply like imagery that they're blowing out their stress. And when the brain kind of sees the bubble go off and disappear or pop, I think it has a relaxing effect. I mean, you visually see something kind of released out of you.
To learn more about insomnia and the brain, log on to brainscienceinstitute.org. I'm Dale Connolly, and this is Brain Talk from Johns Hopkins University.
Stick around for more word of mouth when we return a new theory on why Homo sapiens thrived while Neanderthals died out. And it involves man's best friend, how early humans' relationship with wolf dogs gave them the edge. We'll be back with that after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Genetic and archaeological evidence shows Homo neanderthalus living successfully in Eurasia for about 200,000 years. Then about 45,000 years ago, Homo sapiens showed up. And in the evolutionary blink of the eye, the Neanderthals were wiped out. Their extinction has led to several theories and lengthy scientific debates. Anthropologist Pat Shipman offers a new theory in her book, The Invaders, How Humans and Their Dogs Drove Neanderthals to Extinction. And Pat Shipman, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much.
Well, I guess your title says it all. But first, just to establish kind of what things looked like at about 45 to 50,000 years ago, humans entering Eurasia, what did Eurasia look like back then?
That was the beginning of a period of a lot of climate fluctuation. So it would go from being quite arctic to more temperate, not warm and balmy, but certainly a lot better than snow-covered and tundra forest.
And of course, Neanderthals were on the scene in Eurasia. How did humans and Neanderthals stack up physically, mentally, and even culturally?
Physically, they were similar in size, but Neanderthals were more robust, were stockier, were much stronger. They had brains about the same size as ours, although early modern humans created a lot more objects that you would call art objects or symbolic objects. There are some with Neanderthals, but far, far fewer. So it has often been argued that this means our ancestors were smarter. I don't know that they were smarter. They were smart differently.
Neanderthals, however, had sharper vision. They were stronger, well adapted to this environment, uniquely positioned really to survive, yet they died off and humans survived. So there are a couple theories. The climate change theory, the disease and sheer dominance introduced by a more clever species. And your theory, dogs. What role did dogs play in the demise of the Neanderthal?
My ideas are based on some new work that started coming out of Belgium, particularly under the leadership of a Belgian paleontologist called Mietje Germanpre. And she and a team of collaborators developed a statistical means of distinguishing early dogs from early wolves. Mm-hmm. This has been a problem that has plagued people for years because dogs and wolves are very much alike, but they developed a statistical technique for distinguishing early dogs, and to their great surprise, and mine when I read this work, the earliest dogs they found began to turn up about 37,000-38,000 years ago, much, much earlier than anyone expected. And so I started thinking about what difference it would make if you had a dog. Now, both Neanderthals and modern humans were what we would call an apex predator. That is, they were highly efficient hunters of large game. Having dogs greatly increases the amount of prey you get, how fast you find it, how much you get overall, how hard you have to work to get it. So it's a huge improvement in efficiency.
Mm-hmm. How much difference does it make if they were working with wolves or dogs? Were wolves domesticated?
Not at all. And this is one of the big issues. Wolves are, of course, closely related to dogs. Dogs are derived from wolves. We know that quite clearly from the genetic evidence. But wolves don't care much about people. It's almost a behavioral or an attitudinal shift that must have gone on as wolves became domesticated into dogs. And I use the term wolf dog to refer to these very early dogs because I don't want people to think of poodles or Labrador retrievers. Not that kind of dog.
Let me make sure that I understand that Homo sapiens domesticated or worked with dogs, which meant that dogs would, you know, to make that contemporary hunter analogy, they'd be able to track down game. They'd be able to corner game, probably. What other kind of advantages would the relationship with the dogs offer to the early humans?
Huge advantages. Dogs are good at some things that we are not good at, like tracking by smell, tracking through hearing. We don't do very well at that either. They are much faster than we are. They already, as wolves, would have worked in cooperative groups, in cooperative packs. And there are all kinds of wonderful photographs and videos of wolves in places like Yellowstone National Park today who will go after the biggest animals that are still alive there, which would probably be bison. They will separate one from the pack and half a dozen, maybe at the extreme, 10 wolves will surround it, will hold it at bay, that is not physically hold it, but hold it more or less in place, barking at it, charging it, exhausting it. If then people come in and people had long distance weapons like spears with spear throwers, bows and arrows, they could kill the animal from a distance. This diminishes the risk to the wolf dogs because they don't have to run in there and try to pull this thing down. And then there is the other payoff, which is if you're working with wolf dogs, they will help you guard the carcass.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, hanging around a dead carcass is a very bad place to be. It's very dangerous. They will be particularly alert to other canids, that is, other wolfy, doggy type animals. And so you will know when something's sneaking up trying to get a piece of your bison or, as is the case in the archaeological record, your mammoth.
Hmm.
Because right about the time that these wolf dogs turn up in the archaeological record, these bizarre mammoth sites turn up. Now, prior to this time, if there was evidence of one dead mammoth in a site, that was pretty good. However, all of a sudden, we begin finding sites that have 100 dead mammoths in them.
But here's my question. If the Neanderthals were so advanced, why had they not domesticated dogs?
That's a wonderful question, and I wish I had a definitive answer.
Well, you have really interesting theory about it.
Well, I do. We are unique among primates in having very visible white sclera, that's the outside of the eyeball, outside your iris.
Mm-hmm. It's what we call the whites of the eyes.
The whites of the eyes. And what that does is it makes the direction in which you're looking much easier for someone else to see without speaking or gesturing. So if I look at you and then I look hard to the right, you're going to know where I'm looking. You're going to know I've looked somewhere else. We don't know when this trait arose in the human lineage. We do know that it is not found routinely in any other primate that's alive. It may not have been found in Neanderthals. And wolves, out of all the canids, they have eyes that usually contrast very sharply with the fur immediately around the eye. And if, as you domesticated the animals, if you went for the ones that both had a stronger indicator of where they were looking and responded to it, that is, looked at the other individual to see where they were looking, this makes silent hunting a lot easier.
Scientists have long debated why the Neanderthals, which successfully roamed Europe for 200,000 years, were wiped out. Well, we're talking with Pat Shipman. She's an anthropologist, formerly of Pennsylvania State University, who's written a new book about how dogs gave Homo sapiens a decisive edge. And it is a fascinating theory, Pat Shipman, but you also raise another theory that humans were and are an invasive species. Now, what do you mean by that?
Okay, the definition of invasive species that the U.S. government uses has to do with an animal or plant that moves into a new habitat or a new territory and, by moving in, begins to threaten or outcompete whatever the indigenous species is that was there.
Mm-hmm. In this case, that would be Neanderthal?
That would be Neanderthal.
And would it also be woolly mammoth? Would it also be, you know, saber-toothed tiger, other species that disappeared at that time?
It's more likely to be other predators because we were so predatory. And Neanderthals were so predatory. And we were predatory in the same way. We ate the same animals. We killed the same animals, including mammoths. But this series of megasites, mammoth megasites, is so extraordinarily large. And there are so many of these that come along quite abruptly and not long afterwards, the mammoth populations dwindle dramatically.
If we're looking at Homo sapiens then as invaders, taking over, that would suggest going beyond killing for survival. You know, these megasites, does this show evidence of a human propensity for not just killing to eat, but destruction?
I like to think that's not true. And it's almost certainly true that all of the mammoths in these sites were not killed in one event. It may have been an area where humans knew that mammoths tended to migrate through this valley at this time of year. And so they would go there, they would set themselves up, they would know it was a good place to kill them. And, you know, once you have them, this is a freezer full of meat, basically.
Hmm.
But what I do see, as and why I call humans an invasive species, is because starting with this movement into Eurasia and very quickly eliminating our chief rivals, some of the prey species, and eventually many of the other predators, like saber-toothed cats, that were there that are not there any longer. That says there's been a shakeup of the whole ecosystem.
This deadly combination, then, for some creatures of humans and dogs kind of changes the narrative, doesn't it? It's not that humans were crafty and calculating and warlike, as we thought. So have we been giving our species too much credit?
I don't think so, because if you trace it from these mammoth megasites 30-some thousand years ago to the present, what you will see is once humans got dogs, they kept expanding and expanding and expanding their territory. They went from Siberia into North America, through North America. They went throughout the Pacific, and all of the Pacific Islanders and people in those far scattered regions of either the Pacific Rim or the islands themselves would move in and they'd bring their dogs with them.
So maybe the dogs
eat everything in sight.
Well, maybe then the dogs deserve a lot more credit for the advance of human beings.
Well, I think they do. And I think that the combination of two predatory species with some things in common, like working in groups, and adaptations that are different, all the things dogs can do that we can't do and vice versa, was very, very hard to beat. And I think the period I'm writing about and talking about is the beginning of a long story of people with their dogs taking over every habitat in the world, because that is basically what we've done.
Well, Pat Shipman, thank you for a fascinating theory and discussion. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Pat Shipman, she's a retired adjunct professor of anthropology at Pennsylvania State University and author of the book The Invaders, How Humans and Their Dogs Drove Neanderthals to Extinction. There's more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us as we move from early human interactions with wolf dogs to modern humans' relationship with kept animals. Up next, how one woman is trying to enrich the lives of animals held in captivity by throwing concerts for them. That story when Word of Mouth returns after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There's a wealth of studies about the benefits of music on mental and physical well-being. It's been used to treat chronic pain, Parkinson's disease, depression, and anxiety. But do the benefits of music theory extend beyond humans? Can music help animals? One woman is trying to find out, and Britt Ray brings us her story.
Laurel Brightman got interested in what music animals like because she was writing about how animals go mad. She researches their depressions and anxieties and says that captive animals generally suffer the most.
And it's because captive animals have so much time on their hands. And if their minds aren't stimulated and challenged, they can end up with all kinds of disturbing behaviors. And, you know, boredom is a pretty extreme stressor.
Laurel is a historian of science, but she's not just a researcher. She wants to enrich captive animals' lives by giving them something to do to occupy their time. About 4 years ago, she got an idea.
I read an article that was published in the late 19th century called Music for Animals, and it was an article about all of the Victorian music concerts that had been performed for other animals, things like concerts for elephants in Paris or milkmaids singing to the cows while they were milking them. And I got interested in the idea of what would happen if I decided to do this now.
And now, over 100 years later, Laurel throws concerts for all kinds of animals. For example,
I had the band Grass Widow come to Boston and play for the gorillas at Franklin Park Zoo. Jason Holt of the UK band Spectrum came and droned for sea lions on the California coast. Goodshield Aguilar is a native musician, played for the buffalo in Golden Gate Park. I don't ever open these up to human audiences. The whole point is that it's a concert for other creatures.
And it's on her own dime. There's no research funding.
Until we teach the animals capitalism, I don't expect to be collecting any money at the door. So I can't pay anyone. I haven't been paid. And everyone who's helped me with these has donated their time.
Do you wish you were?
The most recent concert was by Black Prairie, a bluegrass-inspired group from Portland, Oregon. They played for 52 wolves at a sanctuary called Wolf Haven in Washington State.
Wolves arrive at Wolf Haven for all kinds of reasons. Many were rescued from a roadside wolf attraction in Alaska. They were never let off the chain. So until they finally shut down this place, many of these wolves, they'd never run. They'd never touched noses with another canid. Really, they just had the worst kind of life.
On the day of the wolf concert, the band started playing after the heat of the day had passed. The wolves were just waking up after napping in the sun.
The Mexican wolves are standing at the very edge of their enclosure, at the spot that's closest to us, making unbroken eye contact. And the wolves, they're just clearly, clearly interested. They have a huge enclosure, and they could be anywhere. And they're right at the closest place to the band.
Laurel's concert is not exactly a scientific study, but other scientists are interested in the questions it raises, like Mark Beckoff, professor emeritus from the University of Colorado at Boulder. He spent his career looking at wolf, coyote, and dog behavior.
What's so mysterious and so intriguing when you consider the question of music is they're no doubt hearing overtones and sounds that we do not hear, and we can't even begin to appreciate, you know, perhaps the complexity of what they hear in the sounds produced by musical instruments.
One in particular is maybe 3 inches away from the fence, ears pricked, almost like a dog smile.
How can we interpret an animal's psychological state with science?
Well, the use of MRIs on dogs is becoming a very, very good technique. But, you know, just purely observational. Are they nervous? Are they scratching themselves? Are they, you know, sort of looking around as if they're really wary of what's happening?
I don't know. They sort of remind me of people at an outdoor summer concert. They're kind of like paws crossed and next to each other and ears pricked and paying attention, but relaxed.
Versus they kind of cock their head from side to side. They look really uncertain. They approach, they withdraw, they approach, they withdraw. Their gait may be really choppy.
There's no control on this experiment, but biologists have looked at animal appreciation of music in more controlled conditions. Charles Snowden of the University of Wisconsin-Madison works with a composer named David Tai. They've designed species-specific music that includes the sonic frequencies that the animals communicate with in nature. They've done it with house cats and these little monkeys called cotton-top tamarins.
I think the music that we prefer is not necessarily the music that our pets prefer, and we ought to be really thoughtful and careful about that. In fact, if you listen to the tamarin music, it's pretty god-awful to my listening. It sounds like a lot of scratches on a blackboard somewhere.
But they've seen that it effectively relaxes the tamarins.
For cats, we used music that has a tempo of purring, or a tempo of an infant suckling on its mother.
And they say that the cats prefer their kitty music to regular human music.
We could show that the animals preferred to go to the speakers with cat music than preferred to go to the speakers with human music.
Is noticing a difference in behavior enough to say whether or not there is preference? Because preference seems to indicate some sort of likability.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because animals could just not like music at all. And there's a study that was done at Harvard University several years ago where they took the same monkeys that we studied and gave them a choice between Mozart and heavy metal. And they found that when given the choice between Mozart and heavy metal, the monkeys preferred Mozart. But then they decided to do a further test, and they presented Mozart versus silence, and found that the monkeys preferred silence instead. So we have to give them a choice of that sort.
Although Laurel didn't give the wolves that choice, the person who knows them best thinks that they were definitely into it. Diane Gallegos is the director of Wolfhaven.
I was very surprised. I actually thought that once you came in with the instruments that we were going to have to ask you to leave, because I figured that they would be nervous and they'd run to the back. And instead, with the music, we saw the first group come up to the fence and listen, and then we saw the others in the other enclosures coming up to listen.
Really, the only indicator that I have is that they didn't leave, and that's really powerful. And actually, that's really how a lot of musicians judge the success of their show. Did people not leave? Did they not talk? Did they stay and seem to enjoy themselves?
At the end of the show, the band wanted to banter with the audience a little.
The staff of Wolfhaven tried to teach us how to, they call it, initiate a howl. And they said, you lean your head back and you open your mouth and then you howl. And they said they had no idea if the wolves would howl back, but we should try it.
It sounds kind of silly. But then listen to what happened.
And now all the wolves are howling in response.
Who knows what those howls meant? but it's tempting to think it's the wolves' way of calling for an encore. Because it's not like they have lighters to hold up.
Oh my God.
That story came to us from Britt Ray and was produced as part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. As we know, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.